great communicator changed in that time? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest for the entire hour is filmmaker and Des Moines native Chip Duncan. He has a new three-part public television documentary series called The Reagan Presidency. It premieres on Iowa Public Television this Monday. Originally, we told you we were going to also talk today with two University of Iowa Law School professors about the U.S. Supreme Court.
And click on Become a Corporate Sponsor.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you're like me, you find it hard to believe it's been nearly a quarter century since Ronald Reagan left office. So how have our views of the man known as the Great Communicator, a man who had deep roots in the Midwest and also here in Iowa, changed over the last few decades? My guest for the entire hour is filmmaker and Des Moines native Chip Duncan. Over the next three Mondays, Iowa Public Television will debut a three-part series on Ronald Reagan's time in office that he produced. It's called The Reagan Presidency. Chip Duncan produced the series. IPTV is the national station partner for the program. And the first of this series, the first hour, focusing on Reagan's domestic policy. The two following hours, about international policy. An extra note here. Originally, we told you we were going to talk also this hour with two University of Iowa law school professors about the U.S. Supreme Court today in the second half hour. But after watching this film on Reagan last night, we decided it deserved a full hour. It's really an impressive film. Our guests for the U.S. Supreme Court discussion graciously allowed us to move that discussion to next Friday. Chip Duncan joins us by phone. Good afternoon to you, Chip.
Hey, it's great to be on Iowa Public Radio.
Now, we really have the full hour, time enough to stretch out our legs, enjoy this topic, and invite our listeners to join in the discussion. Your questions are welcome this hour about the Reagan presidency. What do you remember most about those 8 years he spent in office? And how do you think your view of Ronald Reagan has evolved over time? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Chip Duncan, this is the first really in-depth look at Reagan's time in office in more than a decade, the first one since 9/11. Tell us, what does this documentary say about the Reagan presidency that we didn't know before?
Well, there's quite a bit that we cover in the film that hadn't been covered before. Part of that is due to the fact that we are not doing a life biography on Reagan. Rather, we're focused on the period of 1979 to 1989, so literally just covering the presidency. And there are many things that viewers might find new and new and improved, but certainly the area that for me was the most significant breakthrough that hadn't really been dealt with significantly before is our coverage of the Middle East policies, all of which really were triggered by 9/11.
And this is a fascinating part, so let's talk about it a little bit. It's explored in this documentary. Middle East legacies that we're living with today that had their origins in the Reagan presidency. What was Hezbollah born at this time, correct?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time in the Cold War as well, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But once we started down the road of really looking at what happened in the Lebanese Civil War in 1982-83, and your listeners may remember the events around the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and the barracks bombing on the Beirut at the Beirut airport, once we started really looking into that, there was a power vacuum that was created at that time when the U.S. pulled out of Lebanon, and that's really when we see the rise of Hezbollah. And you know, so we spent quite a bit of time on the events that led up to that, and then also the Iran-Iraq war. And so hopefully by the time people get to the end of hour three and, you know, into the Iran-Contra affair and a number of other things they may be familiar with, they'll have a better understanding of how we got to that point.
Are there any insights that you can say that tie that time in the Middle East, the problems in the Middle East, with the problems we continue to have in the areas you've mentioned and others in the Middle East?
Well, and having seen the film, I'm sure this came probably as a bit of a surprise to you, but I think it's fair to say that two of our interview subjects, Condoleezza Rice and Robert McFarland, Bud McFarland, as he's called, who was Reagan's national security advisor, they both look at the U.S. pullout from Lebanon as a precursor to the growth of Hezbollah, that had we not pulled out, things might have turned out differently. And for your listeners, they may recall that there were two significant terrorist attacks in Beirut at that time, the first one being an attack on the U.S. embassy that left approximately, I think it was 60-some-odd people were killed in that attack, and then about 270 folks were killed in the bombing at the Marine barracks on the runway, near the runway at the Beirut airport. And, from the perspective of McFarland or Condi Rice, the fact that we pulled out instead of fighting back and pursuing the terrorists may have given the terrorists an opportunity to move forward and just the presumption being that since we didn't fight back, we're vulnerable.
Right, and then that quick pullout referenced by later jihadists that we were a paper tiger, I think.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, if you take a little bit longer view of history and go into the Clinton administration in Somalia, you see more or less the same sort of reaction. So Condi Rice actually says in the film that the fact that we pulled out led to the growth of Hezbollah, and probably we paid the, as she says, we probably paid the price for that on 9/11. And McFarland continues that and says, well, actually, we're still paying the price for that decision. So, it's a longer view of history, and that's what we tried to do with the film, is give people a sense that, you know, whether they agreed or disagreed at the time, those decisions have long-term consequences.
More broadly speaking, Chip Duncan, how do you account for the fact, and how did you treat it in this film, that at the time of his presidency, Ronald Reagan was quite controversial? You mentioned Iran-Contra, certainly a controversial point, perhaps one of the most. And yet in the intervening time, nearly a quarter century, he's become, well, I don't know if almost universally beloved is a way, but in a sense, yes, sort of a folklore hero status. Does this tell us that our history is not accurate in some way?
Well, you know, we're inundated with lots of different kinds of media. I mean, not all filmmakers or not all radio producers are as beholden to the truth as you and we might be in the approach that we take with public media. And so, you know, when politics is politics, and there's been a mythology built up around Reagan that I think we deconstruct in the course of the film. There's no axe to grind. It's simply a case of us talking to political people from both sides of the aisle, and more importantly, to historians and scholars who simply try to set the record straight on any number of issues.
And your goal here was to produce a documentary series that was apolitical?
Well, our goal, much like the film that we did on Herbert Hoover in 2009 with Iowa Public Television, our goal was really to produce a history show, not to produce a political show. And people have asked us on a number of occasions, why Reagan, why now? Well, there's really two answers to that. One is so much of what happened domestically in particular is still relevant. So many of the issues are still being discussed and battled back and forth. So the relevance is part of it. But for me, the other part was that I felt we were far enough removed from Reagan's time in office, and there had been enough scholarly work done that we could do a pure history show and take the polemics out of it.
You've mentioned a number of the interview subjects in this documentary series, Condoleezza Rice, Walter Mondale, George Shultz, Robert Reich, the former labor secretary. He's been on this program as well. Sandra Day O'Connor, Bill Bradley. How did you go about selecting the storytellers who were involved with Reagan at that time as people you interviewed?
Well, the first decision was easy. We looked at who was still alive and very public that had worked in the Reagan administration. So that meant going to people like Ed Meese, who was attorney general during Reagan's second term, George Shultz, who was Secretary of State from 1982 on, and Sandra Day O'Connor, who's the retired Supreme Court justice. So those were easy choices. Interestingly, we looked at Condoleezza Rice not as a Bush cabinet member or as a Secretary of State, but rather she was a renowned Soviet scholar during Reagan's presidency. So we were looking, when we started assembling the team of scholars, who are the people that are appropriate to speak about Reagan from an academic perspective, Condi Rice was one of them. We also have Kyron Skinner, who's a terrific scholar attached to the Hoover Institution, Richard Reeves, who's written the book called The Triumph of Imagination, and then Douglas Brinkley, who probably and rightfully gets the most airtime of the historians that we feature. Mm-hmm. We rounded it out in an interesting way. We were looking for diverse opinions and people who, especially in the foreign policy section, people who lived offshore that could comment from other points of view. So I'm very happy that Oscar Arias, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, was in the film. Your listeners may remember that Oscar Arias was the president of Costa Rica, and he actually negotiated the peace settlement between the Contras and the Sandinistas in Central America. We have a fellow named Andrei Grachev, who was Gorbachev's political advisor, and then a number of younger scholars from Germany and the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, who have very interesting insights from their own countries at that time. So it's pretty well-rounded.
Was there anyone that you sought to interview who declined your invitation, who was not excited about doing that, talking about Ronald Reagan? I notice there's some absences here. Jimmy Carter, Nancy Reagan.
Well, interesting. It's always interesting to talk about who wasn't in the film. Although nobody said they weren't excited to do it. They had other reasons at the time.
Of course.
we did pursue Jimmy Carter, and he said no. And it was kind of interesting because we'd interviewed him twice previously for other productions. But Carter did say no, and then we went after Walter Mondale, who, as you know, said yes and is able to articulate a lot of the same points of view. We went after Peggy Noonan, who said no. We then went after Peter Robinson, who was another Reagan speechwriter who wrote the famous Bring Down This Wall speech, and he said yes, so he is in the film. We pursued a couple of people that said no that I wish had agreed. Chris Matthews was one of them. Chris Matthews said no. We don't know why, but it would have been nice to have his voice because he was, as you may recall, he was the chief of staff to Tip O'Neill, the Democratic majority leader at the time in the House. And so, you know, the speaker, actually. And so there were people that we wish had said yes, but having said that, we're thrilled with the people we got.
It is indeed a fascinating 3 hours of documentary. Filmmaker, Iowa native Chip Duncan with us for this hour. The Reagan Presidency, his documentary to premiere over the next three Mondays at 9 p.m., January 21st, the 28th, and February 4th on Iowa Public Television. Well, we connect the Cold War and its ending with Reagan as perhaps his greatest achievement, even though the Berlin Wall didn't come down until a few months after he was out of office. Let's listen to some, and those interviewed in your film, Chip, make the point that this had more to do with the ascendance of a Soviet leader, we remember, Mikhail Gorbachev, then the political maneuvering of Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev became the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in 1985 after the death of Chernyenko. Here are a little excerpt from your film of some of the people we've just named commenting on this ascendancy.
People saw in Mikhail Gorbachev a much more moderate reformer and somebody who I think a lot of West Europeans felt was someone that they could live with.
When it became clear that Gorbachev actually wanted reform, that was the first glimmer of hope for Europe in many decades.
Gorbachev was a sensation. He was young. He looked healthy. He moved.
The main feature for Gorbachev was not only absurdity, but actually impossibility of the nuclear war. So that meant for Gorbachev that this kind of war, in any case, not only could not be won, but could not be fought.
That from Chip Duncan, the producer of a new three-part series, The Reagan Presidency. A clip from that. Tell us, what did you find most interesting about the Gorbachev-Reagan relationship that you chose to bring out in this film, Chip?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, when I mentioned before the notion of sort of deconstructing myths that have been built up around Reagan, there are two that we get into rather significantly in hours two and three of the film, one being the end of the Cold War and the notion that Reagan won the Cold War. There are a number of people in the film who simply say that's just not the case, including a number of people from his own administration, Shultz and the former Soviet ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock. And they don't take away anything from what Reagan accomplished as president, but what they simply say is that Gorbachev had to exist for the Cold War to end, that it was a mutual effort. Mm-hmm. And that's one example. The other one, of course, is the fact that when the Berlin Wall comes down, a lot of people attribute the wall coming down to Reagan's speech at the Berlin Wall when he says, "Mr. Gorbachev, bring down this wall." Even the speechwriter, Peter Robinson, acknowledges that he's not sure that the speech had all that much impact. And so you get a sense from a lot of our scholars that, yes, it was an important speech, and yes, it was well delivered, but the wall came down for a variety of reasons, a lot of which had to do with East Germany, Poland, the Czech Republic, the now Czech Republic, and so it's just a clearer view of what really happened.
One quote I really love from your film, and I'm not sure who says it in the film, but it really sticks out of my mind, and it's relevant to what we're talking about right now. The quote is something like, "Reagan's vision of America never actually existed, but once in office, he made it come true." Do you remember that quote?
I do. It's a fascinating quote from Richard Reeves. And Reeves, his book is a fascinating book. It's called The Triumph of Imagination. And he talks a lot about the fact that Reagan simply imagined things to be a certain way and then made them happen. And so I think in Reeves' case, it's safe to say it's a kind of an offhand compliment. He didn't appear to be a big fan of the president, but he acknowledges the fact that Reagan, in his mind, is the triumph of imagination. And certainly, you know, when it comes to the legacy, that process continues. I think on the one hand, you could say, well, there are so many significant and dynamic things that an audience can take away from Ray in a very positive way about the president. But when things start going into mythology, and it's a different story. From what I understand from your producing colleague Sarah, you were at the wall in Berlin. Is that when the wall came down? Is that correct?
Actually, yes, I did cover it for public radio in 1989. I was there the day the wall fell down. So that was a great honor for me to be there and experience the joy of the Berliners and the Germans.
Well, and having been there, and I wish I could have been, but having been there, I'm sure you have a sense that the dynamics behind the wall coming down are considerable. And while certainly the U.S. played a role, I think Constance Stelzenmuller, a German scholar in our film, says it best when she says, yes, Reagan played a role, but so did Gorbachev, and so did the East Germans and the West Germans and the Poles and the Czechs. And I'm guessing you had that sense when you were there.
Yes, and in fact, I was in Berlin, I think it was a few weeks or a few months before the wall came down, when Gorbachev visited then East Berlin or East German leader Erich Honecker and gave that famous quote, you'll remember, that history punishes those who come last, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, that did come true. So an epic time in world history. Centered on that very long wall encircling West Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
You bring out the idea in this film that any president, Reagan in this case, comes into office with an ideology, campaigns on an ideology, in Reagan's case for many years, and then has to react to what is thrown at him during the eight years in office in this case. And this is something every president has faced right up to the present. How do you see this story, this ideology meets practical governing evolution in Reagan's case?
Well, there's a number of examples of it. Probably the first one that everybody will remember happened very shortly after he had taken office, when the assassination attempt happened, and you know he very nearly lost his life to John Hinckley. So that's the sort of thing where you can't anticipate the events necessarily that are going to impact your presidency. So there are a lot of people in the film who talk about the president's approval rating after the assassination attempt. It skyrockets, and it made it easier in his first 2 years to pass legislation. Certainly the country was with him at that time. But a lot of the events that happen over the next 6 to 8 years really could not have been predicted. The one that I think stands out the most is that Gorbachev was the fourth Soviet leader he had to deal with. So it's very difficult to try and make peace and plan a summit when the leaders that are in power die. And so he goes through four leaders. I mean, it's Brezhnev, then it's Andropov, then it's Chernyenko, and then finally Gorbachev.
And Gorbachev being one, if I might jump in here, someone like Reagan, because he's younger than Reagan at this time, but he has a Western political sense about him in that he knows how important it is to play in the media, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes through, and it's one of the funnier sections of the show. Actually, it may surprise listeners and viewers, but there are quite a few good laughs in the 3 hours.
Yes.
Gorbachev, he's formidable in so many ways, and one of them is that he's an outgoing, dynamic, popular person in the Soviet Union. And so for a population that's used to a rather dark, kind of dour, foreboding power structure, Gorbachev comes in, and regardless of what Reagan's doing, Gorbachev decides to institute reform. And so glasnost and perestroika become, you know, significant in the Soviet Union and in the ultimate end of the Cold War, because Gorbachev had been widely traveled. He had spent time all over Western Europe. He understood market dynamics in a different way than the previous Soviet leaders. And really, you know, it's well documented that he wanted to bring the Soviet Union into a competitive position as an economy. So that's one of the ways in which I just say we set the record straight, or try to, mm-hmm. is simply acknowledging that you know, without Gorbachev, there would have probably been no summit. There would have been no Geneva, no Reykjavik. And the peace would not have happened.
And the incredible twist toward the end of the Reagan presidency, where these two cold warriors almost agree to eliminate all nuclear weapons that their arsenals possess. We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Chip Duncan is with us, Iowa native, filmmaker. He's produced a new three-part series on Ronald Reagan's time in office called The Reagan Presidency. Fascinating view, to debut, premiere this Monday at 9 o'clock on IPTV. Join our conversation. Your questions, your comments about the Reagan presidency and how it's changed over the years, the view of it, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. My guest this hour, filmmaker and Iowa native Chip Duncan. His new series that he's produced, a three-part series on Ronald Reagan's time in office called The Reagan Presidency. The first hour of it to premiere this coming Monday at 9 p.m. on IPTV. Chip Duncan joining us. Let's talk a little bit about something you mentioned right before the break, the attempted assassination earlier on in the Reagan presidency, John Hinckley attempting that. In fact, one of the very interesting parts of this documentary is that you have some audio and video obtained recordings of the assassination attempt made on President Reagan 69 days after Reagan took office. We'll listen to this approximately 15 seconds, but first, tell us about this audio and what we can be listening for.
Well, it's the audio that happens between various Secret Service agents right after the shooting. So it adds a little bit of authenticity and certainly some drama to that section. I will say that this is a chance for me to just mention that our research team did an outstanding job in the archives, and there's a couple other archival things I'd love to bring in. But one of our researchers is also from Iowa. Her name is Stephanie Ballard, and she's from Cedar Rapids. So we do have a lot of Iowa participants in the production.
Okay, let's listen to this audio from the attempted assassination on President Reagan's life by John Hinckley. That audio, one of the things that has not been heard before coming out in this documentary. Talk about a little bit more about how this really bolstered an attempted assassination, bolstered the Reagan presidency. I remember clearly, and I'm sure you do too, how it was amazing, amazing the recovery that this, he's in his 60s, isn't he? Or 70.
He's over 70 at that point.
He's over 70 at this time. He comes back from a gunshot wound. And this raises his popularity incredibly.
It did. His popularity went all the way up to 76% approval rating following that. And he, his recovery was remarkable on many levels. Certainly the White House press team knew what to do with it from the political perspective. But it really gave him a lot of power and a lot of energy. Once he was recovered, his first speech to Congress was probably one of the most dynamic moments of his presidency. And then as he took that momentum, he was able to push through what was then the largest tax decrease in history. I will say the tax decrease didn't last long. Within another year, the largest tax increase took place. But he had a lot of momentum and a lot of sympathy, and it was, as Pat Schroeder says in the film, who was in opposition to Reagan at the time, you know, it made him a formidable, person to go up against when you're trying to push your own policies. Reagan definitely used it to his advantage.
Let's talk about what you just mentioned, because it's a major theme, especially in part one when domestic policies under Reagan are examined. Your observations about how the themes of Reagan's presidency are still with us today, for instance, the role of government. Of course, we're still talking about that, cutting taxes in order to spur economic development. It's hashed over and rehashed the degree to which Ronald Reagan would have been fitting into the current GOP.
Well, it is hashed and rehashed. In his inaugural speech is probably the most famous moment where he says, in this present crisis, government is not the solution, government is the problem. Unfortunately, that soundbite often gets played back without the modifier at the beginning, which is in this present crisis. And so, you know, we're left with, as Richard Reeves talks about in the film, this notion that government is the enemy, that government needs to be downsized. And Reagan, as another one of the interview subjects says, Reagan didn't actually rule like that. He didn't govern that way. But he had a general respect for what government did bring to the table. But when it comes to taxes and deficits, those issues are exactly the same today. And you get a sense from the film that I think certainly everybody echoed, which is he managed to be bipartisan on those issues. So we get into Social Security reform. We get into the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which were all done in a bipartisan way. And, there was a spirit of we have to accomplish something, and they managed to get it done. So there are lessons to be learned by both parties from watching the film.
Documentary filmmaker Chip Duncan is with us talking about the Reagan presidency. And join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Jim in Iowa City tweets and with this question, Chip, was President Reagan showing signs of dementia during his time in office?
That's a question that I'll have to be honest, I think we skirted a bit in the film because there's very little to prove it one way or the other. We mentioned it in the context of the 84 election and again toward the section on Iran-Contra, but not in a verifiable way. And so I'll add one of the rare cases where I can add my own experience in. I interviewed or met with Reagan and we intended to interview him for a film in 1992, and he, about a week before we were supposed to interview him, he pulled back and his staff and said he'd be willing to read off a teleprompter, but he can't do the interview. So in my own encounter with him in 92, there was a clear sign of memory loss and some challenges at that time. But whether or how it may have impacted him in the presidency, we hint at it, but we were not able to be definitive.
We talked about some of the high points in the Reagan presidency. Let's go the other direction. Of course, Iran-Contra, the scandal there, the arms for hostages deal representing what is recognized as a failure in the Reagan presidency, yet he escaped from that relatively untarnished. One of the other areas that you bring out that I hadn't heard of before, and I wonder how many people who actually know quite a bit about Reagan have. Many historians, I guess, consider, according to your film, one of the lowest points in Reagan's political career to be his first campaign speech. And we're going to hear that, a bit of it right now, a campaign speech he made after he gained the Republican nomination at the convention in 1982. Let's listen to this speech on states' rights given in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
And to restore to states and local communities those functions which properly belong there.
Chills ran up and down my spine when he went to Philadelphia, Mississippi. They could have gone to New Orleans. They could have come to Atlanta. They could have gone almost anywhere in America but Philadelphia, Mississippi, and Memphis.
To many Americans, Philadelphia, Mississippi was a symbol of the civil rights movement and the brutal murder of three civil rights workers during the summer of 1964. But Reagan's speech endorsed his belief in states' rights, not civil rights.
As a historian looking at it, I find it to be the low moment of Reagan's political career.
It wasn't an ideal place for a conservative politician to begin his presidential campaign in 1980. There was some symbolism there that was offensive to many Americans.
It was a clear message to the reactionaries and to the racists of America that they were going to be back in charge.
And Chip Duncan, in this film, in bringing out that section, the people that were interviewed point to the fact that this is perhaps one of the reasons that he was elected.
Well, and to let your listeners know, the gravelly voice you heard there, that's Andrew Young, who was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during Carter's administration and then mayor of Atlanta, and then Douglas Brinkley and a scholar named Kyron Skinner. And all of them and several of our other interview subjects who didn't make it into the cut right there, they all concurred that it was, if not the low point, certainly one of the many low points of the presidency. And what happened was, you know, they chose to, right after the convention, he was nominated, and they chose to go to Philadelphia, Mississippi, to do a speech on states' rights. Now, in today's media climate, in the 24-hour news cycle, this would have been huge news, and there would have been, you know, scores of pundits to debate back and forth. But at that time, it was very few media sources covered the speech. In fact, when we tried to get footage of it or audio of it, it was almost impossible to get. It was one of the rare cases where we simply couldn't find the source material we needed. And yet the arc of that discussion plays out at the end of Hour 3 when that same scholar, Kyron Skinner, talks about how Reagan reformed the electorate. And so, you know, from the standpoint of the civil rights movement and the African American community, it was perceived to be a slap in the face. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of reorganizing the electorate, it succeeded, and Reagan was able to bring a lot of Southern Democrats over to the Republican Party in that 1980 campaign.
Let's talk about what do you bring out in this film that reveals what made Reagan so compelling, both visually and in his speech? What can you say about that?
Well, we don't delve a lot into the character of Ronald Reagan or into his personal attributes as or professional attributes. It's we spend the most time literally on the presidency. But having, as a filmmaker with a great team of people working with me, we were able to look at scores and scores of hours and hours of footage and radio addresses. And I think it's undeniable that he was the great communicator. He had exceptional rhetorical skills. And, you know, certainly that they were honed during his time as an actor. But contrary to a lot of the opinions early on in his administration that he may not have been all that bright, he certainly was. He was quite intelligent, and there's no question that that played into his capacity as what people have called the great communicator.
Right. Reagan, the great communicator, but also our present president, President Obama, lauded for his ability to communicate, but they are very different creatures in terms of communication, aren't they? Are there relevant comparisons you make as a filmmaker between the way these two reach out, make their points?
Well, again, I would say this is more my observation. We don't cover Obama in the film, but a lot of people, certainly not just me, but a lot of people are making comparisons between Reagan and Obama, and some of it has to do with the issues that they're facing. It has helped add a relevancy to our film that I think viewers will find fascinating. But certainly, Obama has extraordinary communication skills as well, and is quite brilliant and you know, speaks off the cuff better than most presidents. And that was something that Reagan was able to do as well. They both exhibit a characteristic that we all love, which is charm.
Right.
They're likable people. They're people that you kind of feel can relate to your own problems, your own challenges. And they both have a fairly ordinary childhood, a fairly ordinary background up until the time they become politically involved. And so I think there are comparisons in terms of the issues they're facing and also in terms of personality.
Let's go to our phones quickly before we end our hour with Chip Duncan, John in Des Moines. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go ahead, please. Welcome to our program.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. I was wondering if there was much effect that Reagan's tax policies had on the lowest socioeconomic people, as far as, you know, a decrease in social services or things that existed under Carter or other administrations that were cut under Reagan due to the tax policies.
John.
Well, there were a number of them, and we get in hour one, you'll see we get into a section on homelessness, and homelessness increased fairly dramatically during the middle part of Reagan's term. Interestingly, the statistics that we keep today were not kept at that time, so the estimates are more broad of a poverty rate of roughly 13% to 15%, and homelessness as many as 500,000 people living on the streets. There were a lot of people who talked more extensively about it that we weren't able to include in the film because of the time that we had on screen, which is about 56 minutes per hour. But Andrew Young made some fascinating points as the mayor of Atlanta about the cutback in social services and in particular cutbacks in military services. So it was not just, you know, the average Americans that were feeling the impact, but also people who had served in the military and saw their benefits cut back as well.
The Reagan Presidency, a 3-hour documentary, the first hour to premiere this coming Monday on IPTV. Chip Duncan, the producer of the film, with us this hour. In talking about filmmaking in this particular case, you said you narrowed it down to not Reagan's life, but the Reagan Presidency. Even that, 8 years as president of vast terrain to cover in only 3 hours. What were some of the hardest choices you faced in putting this film together?
Well, you know, first of all, I have to tell you, just from the standpoint of funny, I mean, most people give us a hard time because it took us almost 3 years to make a film about 8 years. It's just an exhaustive process. But in terms of you know, surprises or things that we learned that we maybe had not anticipated. The real breakthroughs are in hours two and three, foreign policy, around around the decline of the Soviet Union and the impact of programs like SDI and Gorbachev's programs like Perestroika and Glasnost, but most importantly around the Middle East. And I did not expect when we started production to spend the kind of time we did on the Lebanese civil war, on the relationship between Israel and the PLO, and the background information we provide on the Iran-Iraq eight-year war. But having said that, all of those things help inform the viewer so that when we get to Iran-Contra and really the most controversial part of Reagan's presidency, you come at it with a much broader understanding of what those issues were.
Film documentaries as a genre, you're well aware, Chip Duncan, don't have a reputation for being thrilling, the most thrilling category of film, but this is an exciting film. How do you keep a documentary interesting?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. We tried to get across a sense of the urgency that actually exists in the White House or in Washington or in Moscow in this case or Beirut. These issues are fast-paced, and one of the things that I came away with is a much greater sense of the complexity of the president's job and how difficult it is for them, you know, to go from, say, a domestic issue on Social Security reform to, you know, a tragedy like Sabra and Shatila, a massacre in the refugee camps in Beirut. All of these things take the president's time, and they're incredibly difficult. So, I think that's the thing that we came away with. It's the most, probably the most dynamic is that the sense that it's complex. In terms of keeping the pace going, the music, I think, plays a big role. Certainly the way it's edited and the graphics, but the music in this case was composed by a Milwaukeean named Peter Batchelder, and he helps provide a sense of the nature of what that is like. Mm-hmm. What did you think when you watched it?
Well, the new material was what jumped out at me, and some things. This is, as I was remarking to our producer beforehand, Sarah, that when you get to an age where you can actually look back on history and have also experienced it during your lifetime,
right,
it's quite a unique feeling.
Right.
That it's not in something before your lifetime, but part of your lifetime, and then to reflect on it and think it is almost a quarter century that has passed. You did a documentary on something that was in neither of our lifetimes, the presidency of Herbert Hoover in 2009.
Right.
How does that compare with this look at the Reagan presidency?
Well, the Hoover film was obviously very timely as well because it came out right in the middle of a tremendous recession that the U.S. was faced with. But the big difference, and this is I can't overplay this. I mean, the big difference is that we let Reagan speak for himself in this film. He gets a lot of screen time. He makes his own points, and he defends himself, admirably. And that is something we could not do with Herbert Hoover. The archival material simply didn't exist. There were only a handful of film clips where you could actually even hear Hoover's voice. And so I think it's a much more compelling piece in some ways because Reagan is in it and he's able to speak for himself.
Chip Duncan, the last time you were on this program a couple of years ago, I identified you, I think, as a native of Shenandoah, Iowa. Now I'm identifying you as a native of Des Moines. Where did you grow up?
Well, I wanted to correct you earlier, but I was born in Shenandoah and then spent the next 8 years or so in Council Bluffs, Iowa. So I'm a Western Iowan.
Well, we want to make sure all the towns can proudly claim you as a son of that town here in Iowa.
Well,
those listening on Iowa Public Radio.
And we do work extensively with Iowa Public Television. They're great partners. We love working with them. And so I am in Des Moines a lot. And I must admit, when I come through, I usually try to listen to your show. It's a terrific show.
Thank you so much, Chip Duncan, for saying that. Quickly, we have to go in a few seconds. Can you give us an idea of your next project?
Yes, we, with Iowa Public Television, we're working on developing a number of additional presidents. We're hoping that we're able to do Truman and possibly Johnson and Nixon in the next couple of years. We're also trying to find completion funding right now for a film that's about half done on the relationship between J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. and all fascinating projects, all for public television and the great audiences that tune in.
Chip Duncan, thank you for joining us this hour, and we'll look forward to the premiere, the first part of your new three-part series on Ronald Reagan's time in office called The Reagan Presidency on IPTV this coming Monday at 9 p.m. Chip, take care until our next conversation. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks much.
I want to remind you that Monday on this program, special coverage during this time, special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. That's this coming Monday. Tuesday on this program, included in the 23 executive actions President Obama signed this week stemming from that gun violence task force, we'll talk about mental health services and media violence on Tuesday. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Allison Sullivan helped out today, as did Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.